The consciousness of the early man, limited to the physical body, with occasional touches of dream consciousness, is very restricted in its range. He has no idea of the sweep of your consciousness, of your abstract thinking. But is that consciousness of the early man more vivid or less vivid than yours? Certainly you will say, it is less vivid. You have largely transcended his powers of consciousness. Your consciousness is astral rather than physical, but has thereby increased its vividness. As the self withdraws himself from sheath after sheath, he realizes himself more and more, not less and less. Self-realization becomes more intense as sheath after sheath is cast aside. The center grows more powerful as the circumference becomes more permeable, and at last a stage is reached when the center knows itself at every point of the circumference. When that is accomplished, the circumference vanishes, but not so the center. The center still remains. Just as you are more vividly conscious than the early man, just as your consciousness is more alive, not less, than that of an undeveloped man, so it is as we climb up the stairway of life and cast away garment after garment. We become more conscious of existence, more conscious of knowledge, more conscious of self-determined power. The faculties of the self shine out more strongly as veil after veil falls away. By analogy, then, when we touch the monad, our consciousness should be mightier, more vivid, and more perfect. As you learn to truly live, your powers and feelings grow in strength. And remember that all control is exercised over sheaths, over portions of the not-self. You do not control yourself. That is a misconception. You control your not-self. The self is never controlled. He is the inner ruler, immortal. He is the controller, not the controlled. As sheath after sheath becomes subject to yourself, and body after body becomes the tool of yourself, then shall you realize the truth of the saying of the Upanishad, that you are the self, the inner ruler, the immortal.
Lecture 3.
Yoga as science. I propose now to deal first with the two great methods of yoga, one related to the self and the other to the not-self. Let me remind you, before I begin, that we are dealing only with the science of yoga and not with other means of attaining union with the divine. The scientific method, following the old Indian conception, is the one to which I am asking your attention. I would remind you, however, that, though I am only dealing with this, there remain also the other two great ways of bhakti and karma. The yoga we are studying specially concerns the marga of jnanam or knowledge, and within that way, within that marga or path of knowledge, we find that three subdivisions occur, as everywhere in nature. Methods of yoga. With regard to what I have just called the two great methods in yoga, we find that by one of these a man treads the path of knowledge by buddhi, the pure reason, and the other the same path by manas, the concrete mind. You may remember that in speaking yesterday of the subdivisions of antahkarana, I pointed out to you that there we had a process of reflection of one quality in another, and within the limits of the cognitional aspect of the self, you find buddhi, cognition reflected in cognition, and ahamkara, cognition reflected in will, and manas, cognition reflected in activity. Bearing those three subdivisions in mind, you will very readily be able to see that these two methods of yoga fall naturally under two of these heads. But what of the third? What of the will, of which ahamkara is the representative in cognition? That certainly has its road, but it can scarcely be said to be a method. Will breaks its way upwards by sheer unflinching determination, keeping its eyes fixed on the end, and using either buddhi or manis indifferently as a means to that end. Metaphysics is used to realize the self. Science is used to understand the not-self, but either is grasped, either is thrown aside, as it serves, or fails to serve, the needs of the moment. Often the man, in whom will is predominant, does not know how he gains the object he is aiming at. It comes to his hands, but the how is obscure to him. He willed to have it, and nature gives it to him. This is also seen in yoga in the man of ahamkara, the subtype of will in cognition. Just as in the man of ahamkara, buddhi and manas are subordinate, so in the man of buddhi, ahamkara and manas are not absent, but are subordinate. And in the man of manas, ahamkara and buddhi are present, but play a subsidiary part. Both the metaphysician and the scientist must be supported by ahamkara, that self-determining faculty, that deliberate setting of oneself to a chosen end that is necessary in all forms of yoga. Whether a yogi is going to follow the purely cognitional way of buddhi, or whether he is going to follow the more active path of manas, in both cases he needs the self-determining will in order to sustain him in his arduous task. You remember it is written in the Upanishad that the weak man cannot reach the self. Strength is wanted. Determination is wanted. Perseverance is wanted. And you must have